Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Wednesday, December 19th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a program of media criticism brought to you by the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Mike McKean, director of the RJI Futures Lab. Here with me are Views regulars and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Our focus this week, of course, is the mass murder of 20 first graders and six educators at Sandy Hook School in Newtown, Connecticut. Mainstream news organizations reported during the first several hours of coverage on Friday many things that turned out not to be true. Some say they were influenced too much by social media. Journalists and the public hate it when there isn't an immediate answer to the question, why? Attention turned quickly to the availability of military-grade rifles and abundant ammunition, though gun rights advocates suggested school staff should carry their own guns. Others pointed to the lack of adequate mental health services. Plenty of people blamed the media for glorifying gore and too willingly giving deranged people their moments of fame. Many chalked it up simply to evil people finding ways to do evil things. Does research offer hope of answering the why question and helping us do something about mass shootings? You might be surprised how little clarity emerges from the previous scientific studies. Well, let's start our discussion with what we do know, that journalists from some of our country's elite media, in their rush to be first, reported as fact many tips that turned out to be false. The biggest mistake was attributing the killings to Ryan Lanza, not his younger brother Adam. For hours, millions of Americans thought wrongly that Ryan was guilty of mass murder. But as David Folkenflik pointed out yesterday on Morning Edition, that was just the tip of the iceberg.
Their mother did not teach kindergarten at the school, as was reported, nor did she work nor volunteer there, according to school officials. The principal did not recognize and let him into the school. And another report that Adam Lanza had confronted teachers the day before, that was wrong too. What happened here?
That's a good question, and Lee, news organizations would like you to believe that these kinds of mistakes are inevitable given our 24-hour social media-fueled demand for the latest information. Is that a good enough excuse for those mistakes that were made?
Sometimes it is. In some cases, I think it's not. So, for example, what I've read is that a lot of this information actually did come from law enforcement, from people in authority, with this caveat, nobody was willing to go on the record. And journalistically, one of the things we try really hard to do is to get people to go on the record. So it seems to me that if we're going to push anywhere in the fact-gathering process on this, it's to push back on this notion that in order for me to tell you something that I think is worthwhile, I can only say it anonymously.
Well, and Charles, I thought that even though they were, quote, relying on usually accurate law enforcement sources, many of those sources who were giving the faulty information were from the D.C. area who were talking to reporters who weren't on the ground and who weren't on the ground themselves.
Yes, and I covered breaking news with police sources. I know Lee had. I think we all have. I think we can all testify that a lot of the information that you get is inaccurate. I mean, this concept that because a police officer tells you something at the scene of a crime, it's right, is ludicrous. Because I can remember many, many times where there was information flowing in real time out of an event, and they said, we think that, or they don't corroborate, and they're not verifying. The police don't come up to you and go, we now know that the shooter's mother worked at the elementary school. They go, she worked at elementary school. Oh, wait, no, she didn't. They're not going through the same verification process that is incumbent upon journalists.
So, Lee, I mean, the law enforcement officials and first responders, they have a really tough job in these kinds of situations, too. But maybe we just shouldn't trust their early musings as much as we do.
we shouldn't trust their early musings any more than we do in most events. I mean, one of the things that I think being in this situation tells you is that they're scrambling for facts just as hard as you are. They can't go in, for example, to the school and look at the records. That was simply beyond them very early on in this event. So I think those of us who've covered cops for a while begin to get, at least I did, some real sympathy for how much of a scramble it is for police officers to get even the most minimal set of facts at the scene. And I think if we reported it that way, they'd be better off and we'd certainly be better off.
Yeah. And well, clearly this isn't the first time, even with this specific type of action, a mass shooting where the media have gotten it wrong. I mean, I think about NPR reporting that Gabby Giffords was killed in the shooting mm-hmm. in Tucson. I remember ABC's Brian Ross earlier this year using a Facebook profile of all things to claim that the Aurora shooter was a Tea Party member. And yet we always say when it comes down to it that news is a process. It self-corrects over time. And that's the best we can expect.
And that's just so untrue because social media is a process. Gossip is a process. News is a product. It should be a product of process. That process should involve triangulation of sources, for example, just to name one thing. So that if I come up to a cop at a scene and he says, the shooter's mom worked at this place, I don't go, oh, and then turn around and repeat that as fact. I go, oh, and then I go find other people who will, imagine this, corroborate or knock down that assertion.
And I worry, too, Lee, about, first impressions do matter, especially for casual news consumers. That Folkenflik story, which I hope people got to hear yesterday, goes on to talk about how even years later, people have the wrong idea about what motivated the Columbine shooters because of first impressions that the media created. So, and the same thing with Ryan Lanza. I have a suspicion that that young man is going to be tarred with this thing for many years because of bad first impressions.
I think he'll be tarred for life, and that's horrible. And at this point, there's little we can do about it. I mean, we know that people see first reports and not corrections. And whether that's about global climate change or Santa Claus or this shooting, it's a fact of journalistic life. The other thing that we haven't talked about here is in an event like this, there's this huge pressure to keep advancing the story sort of millimeter by millimeter, even when you don't have those millimeters. One of the things I would wish we would so learn to do is to say, we don't have any new information for you right now. Come back in an hour. Go watch a movie. Go think about Syria. Right. Think about the fiscal cliff. You know, stop this 24/7 stuff.
Let's talk about, another mistake, or at least alleged mistake, and that's the notion of poor media manners. I mean, we heard a lot of people from Newtown complaining that their privacy was being violated, that children were being, I didn't see any of this, children being interviewed without their parents' permission. Lots of allegations that occur in a situation like this. From your observation of what you were able to see from the media coverage, how mannered were they in the way they treated, the innocents?
I saw children being interviewed on CNN. I don't know, because they didn't say, whether it was with parental consent, and there were not parents on or around the camera. So I do remember talking to the television at that point going, come on, because, I mean, and we can, Lee knows this stuff a lot better than I do, but talking to an 8-year-old child about a mass shooting, whether you have a grieving parent's consent or not, to me seems to be irrelevant.
The kids had some information. The part of CNN that I saw, which and I didn't get onto TV until about 2 or 3 hours after this had happened because of the press of other business. But CNN for a while was running a couple of things that I think were right. They were running about once an hour. We've only talked to children with parents' permission. Good on them. That's the way it's supposed to be. They were running once an hour. We're only saying the shooter's name. At that point, it was the wrong name. But we're only mentioning this once because we don't want to fuel any kind of notion that people are going to do this sort of thing to get their 15 minutes of fame. So I think there were some things that were done right. In terms of Charles's point, I think what the kids had to add was very time dependent. I was there at the school. I was worried. Okay, now we're done. We don't need to know anymore.
Well, and it does raise very real questions about the nature of consent in that instance, right, where if you're a parent and you have just picked your child up 15 minutes ago from Sandy Hook Elementary School, are you in a position mentally to give consent to anyone to interview your 9-year-old about what he or she is feeling or seeing at that time. I just don't. I was deeply troubled by just the visage of a child on television at the school in the wake of that shooting. Troubled me greatly.
Well, let's move on to the question we said that's on everyone's mind, obviously. Why did this happen? That's a question, I think, to be fair, we may never receive a truly satisfactory answer to. But we're going to get to the media's focus, or some critics would say lack of focus, on the easy availability of guns in just a moment, I promise. We're also going to talk about the media's own culpability. But let's start first at some of the other explanations for the mass shootings and proposals for reducing their occurrence that have dominated the news narrative this week. Firstly, a lot of media experts were out there quoting medical doctors, psychologists, whatever, people who have not seen Adam Lanza and who have not seen enough of the public record to speculate as they were about his mental state, but just generally also on the notion about whether or not adequate mental health services are there to deal or to help prevent these kinds of situations.
I actually would prefer to decouple these two things, because I don't think we've had adequate mental services for many things in this country since the Reagan administration, which is when the federal government started to cut back and cut back and cut back on what it was willing to support. Okay, so that's that. That's a policy thing. One of the things that Charles said, he was deeply troubled. This deeply troubles me. I don't think we know whether Adam Lanza had any sort of what we might call a mental or psychological disability. I've seen no evidence to that effect. Certainly in his medical records would be an invasion of privacy were he to be alive. But I really dislike the notion that we have to find a reason that makes us feel comfortable as human beings, that we glom onto, well, he's crazy and I'm not, therefore he did this, but I never would. And I just don't think we know that yet.
Yeah, I agree. And at the same time, think maybe there's this unfortunate yet fortunate benefit that if this creates a whole lot of attention on the state of mental health care in the United States, then it's a remarkable serendipitous event, I guess, that spins out of this. Because you're right, Lee. I mean, ironically, we don't know right now how closely tied mental health is to this tragedy. And we may never know. That having been said, there's a conversation there that very much needs to be had. That is, I think it's fascinating when you watch the United States begin to have a conversation about something. And we're about to have a conversation about mental health and about guns. And in one case, I expect a much more grown-up conversation than in the other.
Yeah, Lee, it's really interesting. One of the most sort of viral takes on this whole thing so far has been from a mother in Idaho. She posted a blog post called "I Am Adam Lanza's Mother," and she describes in great detail her own son and how she's had to take him to mental hospitals and to get help, and how much she worries that he's going to go off and harm himself, harm her, harm people at school. I mean, it really does sort of strike a chord of both sympathy and anxiety when you think about it.
Well, and I'll add one more to it. If you are married, as I am, to somebody who is a public school teacher, and know that public school teachers on a daily basis encounter students with these sorts of problems, beginning in kindergarten and continuing all the way through high school, then you have another level. My uncle was the person who sent that column to me a couple of nights ago, and I read it, and I thought back to all the sort of problems like that my husband has encountered in his fourth grade class. And I thought, we never talk about this kind of thing in any sort of, as Charles said, in any grown-up way.
I guess it also brings up another issue, and that's parental responsibility. I mean, this mother is anguishing, but she's trying to do the best she can. But we've also heard people asking about Adam Lanza's mother and the fact that she bought all these guns and may have taken him to shoot them. I mean, again, the record is very skimpy at this point, but it does raise the question of what is our own responsibility to report problems within our own families or things that we may see that are going on in schools or other situations where we might be able to help.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a really multifaceted, deeply emotional, incredibly painful conversation on so many levels that we need to have societally. And, you know, guns are a part of it, but they're not the only part of it. I mean, we need to have this mental health conversation. We need to have this culture conversation about the the fetishization of guns and violence in our society. And I think we're starting to look inward in a way that we really haven't in a long time.
Well, let's go there, because the murder of 20 little children has drawn renewed calls for stricter gun laws. Advocates have focused particularly on military-style assault rifles, those high-capacity clips and magazines that can turn a crazy person into a killing machine. They also have called for background checks at gun shows, something that's not required now. But as you've heard so often this week, quote, it's complicated. For example, ABC News Justice correspondent Pierre Thomas quoted government experts who said that no matter what we do going forward, America is already teeming with guns.
Just within 10 miles of the incident, there are 36 gun dealers.
Police believe the guns Adam Lanza used on his killing spree were bought legally.
In America, unless you have a felony conviction or you're adjudicated by a court to be mentally incompetent, you have ready access to firearms.
Lanza now joins the ranks of other mass shooters. And this morning, the nation is left with a perplexing question. How do you keep weapons from men like these, when there are an estimated 200 million plus guns already in circulation?
And naturally, attention has turned this week to the National Rifle Association, one of the country's most effective lobbying groups. The NRA was quick to reject calls for tougher gun limits after Columbine, Virginia Tech, Tucson, and Aurora, but the organization shut down its Facebook and Twitter feeds last Friday and has steadfastly refused comment when asked by mainstream reporters about the school shootings in Newtown. That doesn't mean the NRA has been silent. In fact, Cam Edwards, who hosts the talk show on the SiriusXM Patriot channel and online at nranews.com, explained on Monday night why he has stayed away from social media.
Whatever little good that I could bring to Twitter, I think would be far outweighed by the harm that Twitter would do to me. And so, I'm off for a few days because I do want to be respectful, and I don't mind stepping away from social media. I can resist the peer pressure to tweet. I can do it. We all should be able to do that, by the way. We all should be able to withstand the peer pressure of, you know, instantly jumping on these social networks and just be able to think.
But the NRA isn't lying low much longer. The group has announced a Friday news conference at which it promises to, quote, offer meaningful contributions to help make sure this never happens again, unquote. Well, Charles, first of all, let's just talk about the NRA's reaction. I mean, they really did try to fly under the radar for a long time until this announcement late yesterday that they were going to hold a news conference to talk about how they could be part of the solution.
Yes, and one would have really appreciated at least a word of condolence for the victims from the NRA.
Well, they did. They did issue that also.
Reluctantly. They're in a very, very, very difficult position. The nation turns to them now and says, so what do you have to say about it? They have been unbelievably, incredibly, aggressively outspoken about the arming of the nation. And so now I think the nation looks to see what they have to say about potentially maybe lowering the arms in the nation a little bit. I don't expect a whole lot. I guess my prediction is they're going to say, you know, arm the school children. But if they come up with a more nuanced, more reasonable approach, I'll be happy.
And apparently later today, as we're taping this program, President Obama is also going to outline his first steps, appointing a group, probably Vice President Biden, to lead up a study of all of this. You know, Lee, I want to talk about the media focus on guns for a moment. It seems to me that some reporters, you know, we've covered the spectrum. Some reporters say, yeah, stricter gun laws won't work. Some, like Soledad O'Brien over at CNN, actually attacked gun rights activists while interviewing them. We heard Pierre Thomas pointing out the limitations of dealing with our Second Amendment gun culture. I just wonder what you think has, whether the media have focused enough and the appropriate attention on the gun question so far.
That's a hard one, Mike. So I'm going to say something that's going to be a little bit off center, but I hope not very much. We tend to hook up guns with crime. And I think in some ways that's logical. And I think there's a lot of news stories that have that particular frame. I'm thinking that one of the things that we ought to think about doing is to think about our gun culture really as a public health issue and to begin to frame it in a different way so that we understand that that perfectly healthy people can have guns and that it's not related to crime in a causal way in the way that we'd like to think about it. The other thing that I would hope that that would come up with is that in the name of public health, we regulate a whole lot of stuff that can go in your house. We regulate over-the-counter drugs. We regulate prescription drugs. We regulate, highly regulate, the people who can give you those things. If we were to frame this as a public health issue, then it seems to me asking those regulatory questions becomes much more logical than what I view as the knee-jerk response of, it's my house, and by George, if you come in it, I'm going to shoot you till you're dead.
Well, Charles, let me ask what I think are a couple of related questions to what Lee just said. We had Howard Kurtz, for example, in the Daily Beast, the media critic, saying that in between these shootings that occur unfortunately all too regularly these days, the news media are, as he puts it, MIA on guns, and that maybe there needs to be more of a, quote, media agenda to talk about them.
I think that makes a lot of sense. For example, when AIDS became a thing, right? You remember the first early coverage of AIDS was that there's this disease. Nobody knew very much about it at all. As it grew in significance, journalistic resources were dedicated to it. Then we learned a lot more about it. Then it became part, literally, of the national conversation and continued to be part of the national conversation until we were able to, we haven't solved it by any means, don't get me wrong, but we have confronted it to a large degree. It would seem to me that framing it as a public health issue it's exactly what it is. So why not frame it as a public health issue?
You know, some prominent gun rights politicians, I think, for example, of West Virginia's Senator Joe Manchin, former congressman turned talk show host Joe Scarborough, have come out this past week saying it's time to move away from doctrinaire positions. And I just wonder, Lee, and I know we're speculating and I'm talking about the media focus, but have we reached perhaps a tipping point on this question?
I would like to think so. I'm so skeptical because I've lived long enough and I've seen so many of these things. And one of the things that puzzles me is people say, well, this is more horrific than Columbine. Really, you have a really nuanced definition of horror then, because I went to horror in Columbine real, real fast. So, I would like to think so. I would hope, but I don't necessarily expect.
Well, while we're talking about responsibility, the media have certainly come in for their own fair share of blame this week, Charles. And by media, I'm not just talking about news organizations, but also movie studios, TV show producers, makers of video games. One of the big critiques of the news media, though, is that we give these people their 15 minutes of fame. And if we would just not name them, or if we downplay the killers, that might have some positive effect. Do you think so?
I don't know. I think I did like CNN not using the killer's name very often, maybe at the top of the hour or something. I don't even know why they did it then. We can do what we can do. And one thing the news media can do, I think, is try to step down the glorification of violence, try to be much more critical of the culture of violence, cover it instead of just glorifying it all the time. But we can't do anything about the larger mass media culture of video games and movies and the mega entertainment complex, which literally has no restraints.
And Lee, I know you want to talk about that, but before we go there, just one other sort of related question. There's this critique also that the news media, because we focus so much attention on what are, even though they're horrific events, they're also out of the ordinary, that we create this irrational culture of fear that causes people to worry, to maybe to go out and buy guns or whatever it might be. Do you buy that at all?
I do buy it, because there's some pretty good social science evidence to indicate that if you're a heavy media user, this does not mean people who are overweight, if you watch a lot of television, you will be more fearful of your environment and more fearful in some really bizarre ways. Like, you know, really the murder rate in the United States is not up, but there are a lot of people out there who watch a lot of television and television news who think that it is. So I think there are some ways that we do have subtle impacts on what people are thinking. But I like Charles, think that we cover the crime. We never cover the aftermath. And we ought to cover the aftermath, because that's when it really matters.
Let's talk for a moment about Hollywood, and let's talk about the folks who make these first-person shooter video games. Because, think about these games. They not only, some people argue, desensitize young men to killing, but they even help them develop the skills to do it, Lee.
They help them develop the skills to do it, which is something that the military has taken note of in its recruiting processes. I mean, we as a nation are very conflicted about this because on the one hand, we want people who are competent to shoot those drones. And on the other hand, we don't want the sort of the social side effects of that. Which is why I think that looking at this as a public health issue makes just so much more sense, because then it's a lot of things that get put in that maw.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, Charles, the media have to cover these stories, and we see the new survey that came out from the Pew Research Center for People in the Press that the American public in the aftermath of Newtown are more interested than they have been in these kinds of stories since Columbine. But it also, this survey, and I know we get it, Lee, we're talking about these sort of simple explanations, but they've been asking a question, and it's a binary choice. Is the responsibility for this isolated acts of troubled individuals or broader societal problems? Clearly, it can be both of those things. But the public, I think, must have some responsibility for the way that the media keeps driving the story forward.
Oh, absolutely. And I had an old editor tell me once upon a time, get out of the street and up to the policy. And it reminds me of this moment, because I think that's what we need to do as the news media. We need to get out of the individual incident and get up a level and start talking about the things that create the environment in which these things take place. And I think everybody right now is itching to have that media conversation.
Well, let's say a little bit more about that, because, you know, needless to say, passions can, and I suppose we should say to a certain extent, should drive these policy discussions. But us around the table as journalism educators at an institution of higher learning, you'd like to think that maybe we could go to the scientific literature and see whether it helps tell us why these things happen and what, if anything, we can do about it. We have a link, Lee, on our blog to a pretty good compendium of the most recent studies, thanks to the folks at Harvard University. But frankly, at least in my early reading of it, it's kind of daunting to see that we really don't know very much about root causes, and we don't know very much about the effectiveness of proposed fixes.
One of the things that we know about media history is that every time a new medium comes along, it's going to make you stupid or violent. That happened with television, it happened with radio, it happened with the internet, and it's happening with video games. And then the research community comes along and investigates whether or not this new medium is making you stupid or violent. And lo and behold, we discover that of more than, as I know of now, 7,000 studies for the last 40 years that have been attempting to find out does media content promote violent behavior in certain conditions with certain kind of folks? And the answer is, some of the time, perhaps.
And the scientists have come up with some new tags like rampage violence and the young men who tend to engage in it, pseudo commandos. But if you look at some of the meta-analysis of some of these studies, they also say that, Charles, our definitions are weak, our ability to diagnose things and show how to treat them is pretty weak. I just wonder if we'll ever have the tools, the scientific tools, to do much about all of this.
We can get pretty precise, but at some point, science, the social sciences, are unable to crawl inside people's bodies, minds, and heads and figure out why they're making the decisions they make. And that's frustrated us for millennia and will continue to frustrate us.
We're going to be watching some interesting, you know, developments from this. There was, for example, in Paducah, Kentucky, an interesting incident that we'll have to watch about a young man who said a classmate had brought weapons into the school, claimed the principal or the superintendent hadn't done anything about it, and the newspaper got a letter, gave it to the sheriff's department, but did not reveal the name of the young man who sent the letter. And that's generated an issue we'll have to talk about maybe next time. But that's where we're going to have to wrap it up for today and for the rest of 2012. Thank you for listening or watching. We encourage you, of course, to send your questions, comments, or topic suggestions in. You can do that by email to views@kbia.org, or you can leave them on our blog under the Talk Shows tab on the main page. We also have links there to audio and video relating to each week's stories. Thanks to our technical team, RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers, and thanks to Lee and Charles for another year of insights and opinions about the impact of the news media. I'm Mike McKean. Happy holidays, everyone. Join us again January 9th for our next edition of KBIA's Views of the News.